The following podcast contains spoilers. We strongly recommend you watch the episode of The Americans we're discussing before you listen to this podcast. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Slate's TV Club Insider Podcast for Season 3, Episode 7 of The Americans, Walter Taffet. In this episode, we're going to talk about Fleetwood Mac, drawbridge disasters, and the challenges of being a first-time director. I'm Molly Nussbaum, the script coordinator here at The Americans. I am here today in our writer's office in Brooklyn with my bosses, Joel Fields and Joe Weisberg, and the star of our show, as well as the director of this week's episode, Noah Emmerich, which makes this week's episode The Americans. It's so hard to pronounce that
way. It's The Americans.
The Americans. That's the much better way of getting to it.
We said as soon as you get your first Emmy nomination, we're going to have to start calling you Noah Emmerich.
Then it's really confusing.
I'll take it.
It's a lot of puns all at once. Is this your first time directing for TV, Noah?
It is.
How did that go?
It was great.
What was it like getting the script?
I'm so loquacious.
Yeah, right?
No, it was great. That was the most anticipatory moment of the whole thing was getting the script. Because, you know, they give you your slot. You know you're doing episode 7, but you have no idea what episode 7 is. It could be very action heavy. It could be very emotional heavy. You know, I actually got sort of one of my favorite scripts of the season fortuitously. But as a director, I was really trying to hold on to that first impression. Someone had given me some advice, which is just never lose touch with how you see it. And sort of the freshest, you know, take on that is the first read. So I really wanted to sort of be open to the experience and what bubbled up in my imagination in terms of how I saw what I was reading.
So when you finally got your mitts on the script and really sat down with it, how was your approach as a director now very different than when you first get a script as an actor? And also, you're in this episode. It's not like you were only directing it.
Right.
So did you have to sort of approach it two times in two different ways? Or is a lot of that first impression the way you approach your performance as well?
You know, it's a really good question. It was startlingly different. I had tried to read previous scripts as a director, like if I was directing this episode, what would I do? Just sort of as a warm-up, as a practice, to sort of exercise those muscles. And I thought I had been doing that all along. And then when I finally got the episode that really was my episode, it was inexplicably different. I read every scene with a totally different point of view, really from the director's point of view. How would I stage this? How would I film it? What's the location? What are they wearing? Who's the scene about? Like just the questions, the sort of uber macro questions that a writer has or a director has. I hadn't realized how sort of ingrained I was in the insulated point of view of the character. Even if I'm reading it, thinking I'm reading it as a director, I'm really reading it as sort of Stan on some level. I was not able to sort of inorganically shed that point of view until it really was the script I was directing.
To me, actually, you just seemed happier as a director than an actor. I'm just going to put it out there. You seemed happier, well, maybe 30 to 40% happier.
Maybe I was
much
happier.
He's just trying to say that you're pushing.
I was much happier than Stan. But that's not that hard to do.
That's a low bar. Well, especially this season.
That's a low bar.
Especially even this episode. Like, Stan really has a bummer of an episode in 7.
Yeah.
Like, Adderholt's on his case about Nina. Sandra kind of she says, we need to do something about being husband and wife. She basically says she wants to get a divorce. His friend has died in a plane crash.
Yeah.
He's like talking to Philip about his dating problems.
His son doesn't really want to talk to him.
No. I mean,
that's
Stan's
kind of a typical Stan episode. Yeah.
Stan's kind of having a rough
typical
year.
Stanner day.
I almost said no more puns at the beginning of the episode. I wish I had.
I wish you had too.
It would not have stopped him.
I thought that was a good pun Joel just made. It's interesting, you know, that happened to me on the set. One of the crew who I've known now this is our third season together. I was directing 7 and he came up to me in the middle of the shoot and said, you know, it's funny. I never realized how different you are from Stan. And I was like, wait a minute. I've been with you for like almost 3 years. And like, you're just now realizing that I'm not, because I realize whenever I'm on set, like I am Stan essentially, even if you're not, you know, even if you're sort of between takes or have a few hours at lunch, you're still sort of meditating and brewing and digesting and percolating on the character that you have to perform any minute. So I'm not really myself so much on set. You know, not that I'm some method, you know, deep method in character all day, but to some degree it is tainted completely.
Knowing that big difference, like you were just saying, between you, Noah, and Stan, the character, but obviously having to walk that fine line on set, what was it like directing yourself in some of these scenes?
Difficult.
How do you approach
I'm
that?
I'm so difficult. I almost fired myself twice.
You know, I heard that from you.
You know, directing myself was really relatively easy. I didn't have a problem with myself in the scenes, I did feel sort of somewhat guilty or bad about the other actors that I was working with in scenes that I was in, because I felt I was distracted. Like, you know, they're entitled to a director who's just fully focused on their on the performances and taking care of the actor. And I felt that I couldn't quite take care of them as fully as I wanted to, because I was also taking care of myself in some way. Although it wasn't that bad. It was just that was the one area I felt conscious of and slightly awkward about. But, you know, I know the cast so well, and they don't need a lot, to be honest. Basically, get out of their way, let them make you look good, and you'll be great. So it ended up being pretty smooth and pretty easy. And my fears around it were overblown, I think.
Was there any element of, like, these are all your colleagues that you work with, and now you're telling them what to do?
Well, that first day or two, there was a transitional sort of growing pains of, you know, all of a sudden I've become management. It's like you become the principal. Like, you're with the kids, and you're in the auditorium, and next thing you know, you're on stage going, shut up in the back row. It's like, you know, I didn't want to be – I was self-conscious about that.
It's funny because you also were in the episode a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of the episode takes place – at the FBI, which is a set you're very familiar with. And in a way, you got to be the director who took those characters through probably the biggest transformation of that place that's happened so far.
Right. And we got to use the set in a bigger way than we ever have before. You know, the FBI, we really used the whole bullpen, we call it, that big main area.
And built a bathroom. That bathroom does not exist on that set.
No.
FYI.
Yeah.
And we had many, many discussions about how many stalls would be in that bathroom.
You were like, there've got to be four. I'm not shooting this scene unless I get four stalls.
Yeah. We ended up with three, though. So that's why the scene's a little weaker than it could be.
We insisted. Oh, I just arbitrarily, I knew it would be three, so I insisted on two. I knew we'd close at three.
Yeah, I always imagined that this particular, the character, I guess this is for people who've already seen the show.
Yeah, so yeah. You're no not spoiling anything.
Okay, so when Martha walks down those stalls, I just imagined a long walk, almost like a plank walk, you know, walk back into that corner of the room. I wanted it to feel ominous and clickety-clackety, you know, solitary. And it just, it was too short a walk, it seemed, it wouldn't have that tension. But there was a budget issue. I mean, this is what it comes down to. This is the other, this is one of the big things, is that where the compromises come from, why they need to come, how you figure out how to work within the constraints. I think it's ultimately probably more creative and more interesting because of the limitations you're forced to come up with interesting ideas. And some of the things you think you need for sure, you actually don't at all. Like the stalls. Like, I really wanted at least four. I think we had three. And originally I thought, like, well, six, it's going to be like a bureaucratic government bathroom. It's going to be huge, you know. But that's not our budget exactly.
I was trying to talk you out of that. I was like, oh, no, there are definitely three stalls at the FBI.
Yeah.
Making that shit
but,
up.
You know, actually, but that led to a conversation with Diane, the production designer, who was talking about sort of creating the lines of the bathroom so it would appear to be longer, and the visual where the lights were and the lines of the floor and the tiling, so that we actually, that led to a really constructive conversation about how to find what I was looking for in the number, maybe other ways visually.
Did you feel cheated because you did not get to work closely with the male robot in this episode?
You know, I felt cheated because I had no Russians and no male robot. I had no Russians. It made my life easier, certainly because I don't speak Russian. And that's always one of the things I was really curious about. How do you direct these scenes where you don't speak the language? And the male robot, I think, saved me, was what enabled me to come in on time and on budget.
You know who was really bummed out, actually, is Frank Langella. Because he had said to us many times how much he loves you as an actor and wanted to work with you. And we assured him early on, don't worry, Noah's directing an episode, so at least you'll get to work together that way. And lo and behold, one of the few episodes without
Frank. It was incredible. And I was so excited to work with him. You know, I'm a huge fan and I love his work. And I thought, well, I'm going to be able to direct Frank Langella. This is going to be so amazing. And there was a brief moment where I thought I was, in fact, directing him, and then there was rewrites and changes, and he ended up not being in this episode. And
originally, you were barely in the episode. I mean, that was the idea that we would write an episode for you to direct, and you would barely be in it, so you could direct it.
Right.
And then just scenes kept getting added, and added until you were in it probably more than a usual
episode. Yeah. You were, although it worked out from a practical standpoint quite well, because you were not heavy in episode 6, the prior episode, which really allowed you to prep.
Right. And 8, I was pretty light into, which allowed me to edit. You know, so actually, I think that's actually a better way to do it. It didn't matter that I was in it or not. Like, that didn't take up time. It's the one before and the one after that are more critical.
Well, one of the huge set pieces, which I remember extensive prep went into, and we actually still have to this day in our writer's room, the diagrams that you guys drew out for it.
The diner.
The huge set piece, abduction scene at the end of the episode. And that changed in the script so many times. And then again, when we found the location, it changed again. And I remember, like I said, on the whiteboard, you and Dan Sackheim and I think Mike Fucci from Locations all came in and started drawing it out and very animatedly started acting out the scene in the writer's room, which was very entertaining. Yeah. When you first read that, when you first got the script, were you just like, come on, guys? Like, were you super intimidated or annoyed that it's like my first time out of the box and you're giving me this?
I was like, holy shit. Yeah, wow. There's like the one thing I didn't have an appetite for, didn't think it would be great to give to me was any sort of big action sequence. I thought, that's not my forte.
We got something for you.
Exactly.
This is big for this show. That's
It was like, this is not my thing. Like, I'm emotional, I'm dramatic, I'm interested in maybe some comedy, but action, like, just don't give me any actions. Please don't give me any action. And then there's this big action set piece, and I realized that's exactly what I wanted, you know? I mean, with the help of a friend I was talking to, she said, well, of course you can do. Why don't you think you can do that? Just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't do it. And I was like, you're right. All I got to do is, like I said earlier, see when I read it, like, what do I see in my head? And then just literally break that down piece by piece and figure out how to do it. And it was actually great puzzle and great fun to do.
Excuse me. Do you have the time?
Sorry, I can't help you. I don't know.
And it's funny, everyone around me, especially Dan Sackheim, who was, sort of my mentor, producing director, who really held my hand through a lot of this. He was like, I don't know, you seem a little bit too calm about this action. Like, I was like, I got it. I promise you, I got it. The tables turned so much. And, at the end of it, he said, I'm amazed. You did. You got it. I was like, yeah, it isn't, if you break something down, it's just step by step by step.
Well, it seems like you did a lot of that throughout the process, and it was a great way to not be intimidated by any of it, and yet you drilled deeply into all of it. And that whole episode, how many days did you shoot the episode?
Seven
days top to bottom.
Seven plus a couple of hours of a tandem on a hanging Chad day, but basically 7 days.
Well, we heard that when the going got rough, it's like you ran into a real problem on a drawbridge and you still like just worked your way right around it.
What happened there? Things are very different on paper than they are in life. One of the other directors said to me, they're going to give you a schedule and they're going to tell you, this is your schedule. You have to make this. And just so you know, that schedule is not makeable. It's not real. No one makes it. It never will be made. It's built in to be not makeable.
We don't feel that way.
Completely makeable schedule. We don't know what your problem is.
Ow! Ow! Joel! Ow! Ow!
You know what? You bought yourself a 6-day episode next season, my friend. 6 days. I think you can do it.
So, apropos that, this is a real truth. Like, so they write down a company move, which means we're shooting on location away from our stages, tons of trucks and equipment and people to move. And then it says company move, which means you're moving from location A to location B, which could be a 5-minute drive away. It could be an hour drive away. This one was supposed to be a 20-minute drive to the next location. And they schedule that move for, half an hour, 40 minutes. But the real company move, no matter, even if you're going a block away, by the time you load the trucks, unload the trucks, move all the equipment, it's at least an hour. That's not part of the schedule in the strips of the day.
And we don't also feel that way.
And also not part of the schedule is the drawbridge.
Now, this 20-minute drive from location A to location B.
In fairness, half the crew made it.
Exactly. Just not the lights or the cameras.
You should have just shot the first half of the scene.
Well, if the camera truck had made it first, we would have been fine. But the drawbridge, the cars are loading and they're driving from A to B. And sure enough, the drawbridge that is midway between A and B goes up. And half of the cars got stuck behind this drawbridge.
You had no ropes or ladders?
We had no whistle. If I had had a hot wire, the drawbridge, I would have lowered it myself. But they were, we got to the location. It was a snowstorm day. It was a huge exterior scene. The scene where Elizabeth and Hans are staking out Ninkobo.
Noah's on his cell phone with the mayor's office. Put him on. I don't care.
So, and we just couldn't figure out where the camera was. Where's the camera team? Where's the camera crew? Where's the equipment? Where are the lights? And they were sure enough stuck behind this drawbridge for, you know, half an hour, which is, you
which
know,
is money, a fortune worth money. Of money. That's, yeah, why, that's, we, that's the, why everybody cares.
That's the biggest change in perspective that I had as a director. The biggest change is time. Like your
it's
relationship
time.
To time.
It's really the
time
the
equals
time
money.
Equals money and money yeah. equals time. So what happens and what we struggle with often are questions about these company moves in these locations. Well, if it's going to be a move, what that really is, you can look at the dollars and cents, but at the end of the day, that's time that you're not shooting the scene in a closer location.
Right.
So that's what you have to balance right. out always. And unless you have unlimited resources, each of these things is a compromise. And sometimes the location is so important that it drives that. But other times, boy, you really, you prefer to take that time to get the scene.
You know, the worst thing for an actor, this happened to me one time on set and I got mad about it, but we were, you know, I was shooting a scene at the end of the day and it was a hard, challenging scene, gentle scene. You need to feel like you have sort of infinite space and time to play with it and to get it right. And the producer walked on set and was like, "All right, guys, you got 15 minutes to get this. 15 minutes to get this." I was like, "What?" That's the last thing an actor ever wants to hear. It's just like, "Okay, write the scene. You have 7 minutes." Like, what? I can't, you know, what? So the actors need to feel like there's infinite time. There's no pressure. Like, we'll do 20 takes, relax, but you only have time for two, but I'm not going to tell you that. You know, that's part of the game.
It's funny you mention that because people notice sometimes I wear my watch on my belt,
right?
Which is an odd place to wear one's watch. And the reason I wear my watch on my belt is it started when I would be on the set and I just felt that that looking at my watch on my wrist
right.
was too much pressure and kind of rude to everybody.
Right.
But if I had it on my belt, I could surreptitiously glance down and see how we were doing.
Right. Exactly. You never want to be caught, you know, looking at time or talking about time from the actor's point of view, you know. From the crew's point of view, you don't mind having them know, "Hey, guys, can we hustle a little bit?" But the only way to do that is never to say hustle. It's just to hustle yourself. If you hustle, they'll hustle. Like, that's one of the things I really felt, you know, was important to do, was like, don't walk. Like, walk quickly. Don't, like, you know, directors, you know, I didn't sit down, I don't think once, any of the days that I directed. I was up. I like to be in the scene, like to be near the people, like to see what's happening. If you're sort of sitting by Video Village with your headphones on, waiting for some AD to call action, like, you're not really leading the crew. You're not really inspiring people to, like, be efficient or fast or energized. So I felt like it was important to be sort of in the game. And, you know, look, there are genius directors who sit in their trailer and watch on the monitor. There's no right way to do it. But for me, what felt right was to be sort of with the troops in the trenches, you know, making sure mustering as much spirit and, you know, esprit de corps as we could get.
Was one of the big changes for you, I mean, when you're an actor, obviously, when you're done with the episode, when your work is done, you move on and you start
right.
looking towards the other episode, or you're shooting pickups from other things. But with this, not only did you get the script ahead of time to prep it, you shoot it, but then you got to follow the episode into post-production.
Yeah.
Did you really enjoy spending so much more time with the episode, and how did that sort of change your relationship with what you had shot and sort of the way you would approach maybe your next directing experience?
Right. I love post. I mean, production is fantastic, and I loved it, and it's exciting, and it's sort of like war, but, you know, in terms of like the adrenaline and the mindset and the limited time. But post is where you really craft and shape and make the episode. And I love editing, I love scoring, I love every element of post.
What was your biggest surprise in post-production on this episode?
How much structural work you guys are particularly open and talented at reimagining structural design of an episode. So you shoot it with, you know, transition shots in mind, and you think this is really A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And then you come in and go, you know, how about if we put A, F, C, G, Q, Z, and then M? And it's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, my brain didn't have that muscle at all. I wasn't imagining that. And wow, it works better. It looks like it was written to be that. Like, so the flexibility, the openness of reorganizing and reimagining a storyline in post facto, you know, literally it's been shot and you're changing the storyline, and how much that works. In fact, I had a thought today because I've sort of caught the bug. We're watching the mix, this picture's locked, and I had a thought about changing the scene order that I wish I had brought up and just try. That's the thing, you're never finished with post. You can always, you're never finished, you just stop. You know, you're not really done. Someone just takes it away because I still have some cut ideas that I would love to try.
Well, the adjustments you can make are mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I mean, you could literally make a funny scene serious, a serious scene funny. There's no tonal or emotional adjustment. I mean, I may be exaggerating a little bit.
No.
But it's pretty mind-boggling what you can do.
No, and by adjusting the scene order or even internal scene stuff, pulling lines out, you really can change things. Stephen Bochco always said that editing is the final rewrite. You get to keep it. Editing is writing. That's what he said.
It's totally writing. And I love it. And I love the fact that there's no... that there's no elements out of your control. There's no snowstorm that's going to come. There's no drawbridge that goes up. There's no camera that breaks. It's just really comfortable. You're warm. You got a coffee maker.
You sit back and say, do this, and the editor does it.
And it
I like that part.
And it happens.
I like that part.
Well, I'll tell you one that was a big surprise to me was the song. At the end, the song. Because
Fleetwood Mac.
Initially, the idea was score, but it felt like it kind of dropped in and out and didn't really support the scene. And then when we finally found the song, it starts much earlier now over Martha.
Actually, it starts now over Philip kitchen.
That's right. Yeah. Before going to Martha. And then looking for that song was a whole story in and of itself, because where we started really was looking for a song that would underscore the action.
We had the Rolling Stones
first. Right.
And it wasn't. Yeah. And basically the trick was finding a song that underscored the themes and characters and the action played.
And I love it's so good. I mean that I feel. I mean I love the cut and the way it lays in. It's really beautiful. And I had always imagined a different song. Like I had imagined this Rolling Stones cut, which in pre-production I was talking with our music supervisor, and you know he.
Did you have it in your head when you shot it?
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah. I mean that song was great, by the way. That song did work.
Yeah.
You know
which song?
Slave. And I knew there was a really good chance it wasn't going to be that song, but I just thought it's not a bad template and the pace and the shape of it. My biggest fear, I didn't have any, I mean, the surprises were more relieves. That, you know, I did a couple of scenes where I kind of, and I remember speaking to you guys about this before I shot, saying, you know, how okay with you guys are, because we talked about the style and being economical and being visually sort of minimalist in some areas and what you can communicate without too much coverage because of the time constraints. And I remember thinking, are you okay if I don't have coverage on everything? Like if I don't, you know, if I try and do something in a one-er, like that's kind of a risky thing to do and terrified me. Although there were a few scenes where I really thought this is the way to do it and it's going to save us. And it's actually how I think it's ideally to be shot, and how it serves us on the time front is really great. But I was terrified of getting to the cutting room and having the editor go, you know, well, we need to cut something here. And you then know- you...
Yeah, I think like we were at the mix today and we were watching the whole episode, and there was this scene where Philip and Elizabeth are in bed.
Yeah, that's
where Philip tells about his son. And I feel like more and more, I feel like just those are the scenes. There's maybe one per episode if you're lucky, but sometimes there are two per episode. Sometimes there's an episode without one. But those sort of incredibly intense emotional episodes where something gets revealed or something happens between Elizabeth and Philip that is so both emotionally intense and could only happen on this show. There could only be that kind of discussion on this show. And those are the scenes where there's like six distinct emotional beats where things are said and reactions are happen. And that's what you can't miss.
Right.
That's what you can't miss. It's the only thing that you can't really screw up or it'll fuck up the whole episode.
Right.
You know, and the kind of the one.
But that scene was shot, that was a one-er.
That's right.
There's no coverage in that scene.
There's no coverage in that
it's
scene.
It's two characters at the same time, live on camera in the same frame. So you need performance from both of them to be perfect or, you know, and I was terrified because I really thought that was going to be a one-er and I really didn't want it to be edited, because when the emotional through line is so strong and so much is happening, I feel like editing sort of gets in the way, like let the actors breathe in the frame. But I was... That's exactly the scene, like that's the foremost in my mind in terms of fear. Yeah. But we did it and it worked. And
it's funny you talk about actors together in the frame, because something I don't know whether we talked about with you explicitly or whether you heard it in some of our prior tone meetings. But one thing we often say to visiting directors is, as much as it's important for us to go fast and to get the show in its unrealistic schedule, one thing people often do to shave time on these television schedules is walk people into overs and not get two shots.
Right.
Because if you walk somebody
right. yeah,
into an over, you isolate them and you've done that side and you never have to get the two shot. And the problem with that is what you don't get is two actors in a frame playing together.
Right.
And in a way, I think of that scene that you were talking about with Philip sharing the secret about his son after Elizabeth has reached out and apologized. Elizabeth
right.
Jennings apologizing for not telling him about what she did with their daughter.
I think to you, that's the bigger bombshell in this episode than the finding the bug at the FBI.
Oh my God.
Is that
God,
Elizabeth
Of course it is.
The bug was eventually going to be found. Elizabeth Jennings apologizing? I mean, come on. You know, I think that's, you know, podcast listeners, tweet your thoughts, but there's no question that that's the bigger surprise. But your choice to get that in a oneer, someone might say that that minimized editorial options, but I would say what it did was force the actors to play together in that frame and make those moments very real. And had you been playing those in separate pieces, you wouldn't have had that level of intimacy that you got
right.
there.
Well, guys, thank you so much for talking about episode 7.
Hold on,
seven.
Let's talk about the next scene. Wait a minute.
This podcast was recorded over 9 days. Noah Emmerich, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, well, thanks for having me.
Joel Fields, Joe Weisberg. I guess it's nice that you're here,
Molly
too.
Molly Nussbaum.
We got to
go.
Hey, we have casting to take care of. We have editing
you
to do.
You do your sign-off?
This is my sign-off. I'm Joel Fields. We have casting, editing, and things to do.
That's it for this week. Join us again next week when we talk about episode 8, Divestment, with Allison Wright, or as you may know her, Martha, as well as our stunt coordinator, Ian McLaughlin. A big thank you to our producers, our producer, Henry Malofsky, our executive producer, podcast overlord, Andy Bowers, and Laura Mayer. I'm Molly Nussbaum. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. That's PANOPLY.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.